The Supreme Court in Brazil is sending the former president, Jair Bolsonaro, to prison and sending a message.
If someone attempts to break the rules, to break democracy in Brazil, they cannot escape from that. They will be punished for that.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Russian drones entering Polish airspace are putting Eastern Europe on edge. And why genetic testing for biological sex in sports is so controversial.
There's no clear boundary about what counts as unfair advantage. This, I think, exposes how subjective and political these kinds of regulations are.
Then a new government minister is actually an AI chatbot. What could possibly go wrong?
In the case that this AI makes a mistake, who is going to be accountable for it?
That's ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us on this Friday. We begin today in Brazil. Crowds there have been celebrating in the streets of the country's capital. Brazil's Supreme Court convicted former President Jair Bolsonaro on Thursday, sentencing him to 27 years in prison. He was found guilty of plotting a coup after losing the 2022 presidential election in Brazil. Bolsonaro is one of the world's most prominent far-right leaders. This is the first time a Brazilian president has been held accountable for trying to subvert democracy. The World's Tabitha Isaiah reports on what this moment means for Brazil and what comes next.
Jair Bolsonaro's conviction didn't come as a surprise. There is overwhelming evidence showing that he spent months undermining trust in Brazil's electoral system, and that when he lost the 2022 vote, he began planning to dismantle the Supreme Court, hand power to the military, and even assassinate President-elect Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Four of five justices voted to convict. Carmen Lúcia is one of them.
Ele é o causador, ele é o líder de uma organização.
He was the driving force, the leader of an organization that orchestrated every move to hold on to power, she said yesterday. For many Brazilians, the ruling marks a turning point, a sign that no one is above the law. But the case has also polarized the country. Bolsonaro still has a loyal base, and his supporters have been taken to the streets. At a recent rally in São Paulo, protesters denounced the ruling as politically motivated.
Eu acho totalmente errado. Perseguição política, na verdade, né?
This is totally wrong. It's a political persecution, said Edmar Preto in São Paulo. He says he doesn't trust Brazilian institutions. But many legal experts maintain that the trial was fair. Oscar Vilena Vieira is a respected constitutional lawyer in Brazil.
Bolsonaro had a fair trial with due process. The irony on this case is that the law that is being applied to him was approved during his government, and he signed this bill.
For many, this trial is bigger than one political figure. Leninson Barbosa, a member of the LGBTQ community, which was frequently targeted by Bolsonaro, welcomed the court's decision.
Esse processo mostra que a justiça deve proteger a sociedade contra práticas autoritárias.
This shows that justice must protect us from authoritarianism, he says. For him, this conviction is also about recovering trust in a democracy that includes everyone. Mauricio de Melo Ribeiro, a pro-democracy activist, says the ruling is necessary for the future.
Neste momento, nós estamos com uma democracia em construção.
Our democracy is still a work in progress, he says. And it's really important that we keep pushing to make it stronger. Brazil has seen more than a dozen military coups or coup attempts since the end of its monarchy in the 1800s. But never before has a coup leader been convicted. Claudio Gonçalves Cuoto, a political scientist in Brazil, says this sets a new precedent.
That if someone attempts to break the rules, to break democracy in Brazil, they cannot escape from that. They will be punished for that.
Bolsonaro's legal team says they will appeal. But experts say it's very unlikely that it will succeed. And one of Bolsonaro's sons, Congressman Eduardo Bolsonaro, is pushing for an amnesty bill in Congress. But the legislature is currently controlled by the left, making that path difficult, at least for now. The ruling leaves Brazil's political right without a clear leader. Still, Bolsonaro remains a powerful force. Political analyst Jussara Soares says that even from the sidelines, his influence is hard to ignore.
Não se pode construir uma candidatura sem o apoio de Bolsonaro para derrotar Lula em 2026.
No right-wing candidate can build a successful campaign without Bolsonaro's backing, she says. The next presidential election is next year. President Trump, who's a close political ally of Bolsonaro, said he was very unhappy with the conviction.
I thought he was a good president of Brazil, and it's very surprising that that could happen. That's very much like they tried to do with me, but they didn't get away with it.
Observers say the U.S. might announce new sanctions against Brazil or Brazilian officials soon. The polls show the majority of Brazilians see Bolsonaro's trial as fair and reject U.S. interference. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
In Albania, the country's prime minister, Edi Rama, named a new member of his cabinet on Thursday. Her name is Diela, and she'll be heading up Albania's Ministry of Procurement. Here she is, introducing herself.
Mirë erdhët në Albania. Unë jam asistenti juaj virtual.
Even if you don't understand Albanian, this sounds a bit uncanny, right? That's because Diela is an AI-generated chatbot. Prime Minister Rama has called her the world's first AI-made government minister and says the bot will help the country root out corruption in its procurement system. Amy Kokolari is an AI researcher based in the Albanian capital, Tirana.
It sounded as a PR stunt to many. And in fact, the prime minister was talking about it already during the summer, but no one really thought that this could be even feasible. So it felt like some sort of far-fetched dream that the Albanian government had, but apparently it is definitely not a dream, but it's reality. As yesterday, the prime minister announced the new government, and part of the new government was Diela as public procurement minister.
And she is supposed to do what? She is supposed to fill all the government contracts?
So the idea is that because of the history of Albania with public procurement, which is not necessarily very positive, as also, most of the rule of law reports from the European Commission has showed in the past few years, Albania has been struggling with corruption, especially when it comes to public procurement. There are a lot of situations in which there have been conflict of interest, and these kind of contracts have been used by private companies for money laundering and pursuing their own private interest. So what the idea of introducing an AI minister for public procurement comes from this issue and trying to solve the issue of corruption, especially when it comes to public procurement. And what Diela will do is basically matching the private companies with the tenders and the calls for tenders, and basically seeing whether or not they are able to fulfill all the criteria, whether they are the right match for the tender. And this would be done in a transparent and completely fair way, supposedly.
So the idea is that, you know, a government official might be able to be bribed or be given contracts to a friend, but an AI chatbot is not human, so it will just go on the data?
Yeah, exactly.
And how realistic is that as a tool to root out corruption? I mean, people are programming the chatbot, it is being trained on material. Both of those things could be biased.
Well, for now, the information that we have is not much, to be honest. We know that Diela has been used as a virtual assistant since January, and she has been used for the government portal, which is called eAlbania.
That's the public portal for people to access government services?
Yes, exactly. So basically what Albania has been trying to do in the past few years is to digitalize all public services. And for now we have 95% of public services, more or less, that are online. And basically, people from everywhere, diaspora, also can access their documents and any kind of public services online. And the DLI is an assistant, is a helper in the case of when citizens need to understand how to access documents and so on. But now she has been upgraded to minister.
Hmm. You mentioned that corruption is a big problem in Albania, specifically in public procurement. Just give us a sense of how big of an issue it is there compared to other places.
Well, it is definitely one of the biggest issues that has also been highlighted by the European Union. So I would say that is the biggest hurdle when it comes to being able to access the European Union. And it's the main challenges is the fact that we're not only talking about grand corruption, meaning that it happens on the political level, but we're also talking about petty corruption, meaning that also because a bit of the history of the country, we are facing situations in which the daily life of people is definitely defined by acts of corruption when it comes to healthcare, when it comes to just as we were talking about getting your documents done. So it's everywhere. So this is why I'm also a bit skeptical when we're talking about an AI tool eradicating corruption, because corruption is not just about something that can be dealt with technological tools, it's something much more societal, cultural, and systematic.
And pervasive, it sounds.
Yeah.
What are you going to be watching for to see if this AI minister does end up having a positive effect on corruption in procurement?
So I think one of the most important things that we should take into account when talking about AI and AI and governance is definitely transparency. So trying to understand how this AI is trained based on which data, and also matter of accountability. So in the case that this AI makes a mistake, who is going to be accountable for it? So there is no political accountability. So definitely three things that we should take into account: transparency, accountability, and also health of democracy. The democracy of a country should be very, very well established and healthy for this tool to really function.
Amy Kukulari studies artificial intelligence in the Balkans. She spoke with us from the Albanian capital, Tirana. London's underground trains are back in service today after a five-day strike. Union members walked off the job this week over pay, hours, and working conditions. Severely limited tube service forced London commuters to find creative ways to get around. One interesting effect of the stoppage: a huge increase in the number of people using bikes, which caused some chaos in the city's bike lanes.
Everyone is mental! Line bike mental!
Videos posted to social media show bike traffic grinding to a halt because the bike lanes were too full. E-bike rental companies like Lime and Forest reported a huge jump in use, up to four times higher than normal. Bikes and overground trains also picked up much of the slack. They collectively carried about 1 million extra passengers daily. One of the major sticking points in negotiations with the union is working hours. Tube operators are calling for a 32-hour work week to help with fatigue and improve work-life balance. London's transit operator says that would be too costly. London Mayor Sadiq Khan, who's come under fire for staying out of the negotiations, made a brief statement on the situation yesterday.
I know how hard it's been, especially for those trying to reach hospital appointments, get their children to school, or simply get to work without the option to work from home. That's why I'm urging the RMT and TfL to return to the negotiating table.
Even though the strike has ended, the union and the transportation authority have yet to reach a final agreement. Tube operators could vote to walk off the job again if they can't make a deal. Up next on today's show, why Spanish laws governing forests may need to be changed. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Spain suffered its worst wildfires in 30 years over the summer. More than 1.2 million acres burned, largely during just a 15-day heat wave in August. But one notable pine forest did not ignite. It is the largest one in Spain. Some say one reason why the Urbión forest was spared is the draw of pines. That is a tradition that dates back to medieval times. It incentivizes local people to work in the woods and maintain them in order to reduce the risk of fires. But as the world's Jerry Haddon reports from Soria, the old custom is facing modern pressures and may no longer be the panacea it once was.
The Urbión forest goes on and on and on, covering nearly 500,000 acres. It's as remote and rugged as it gets in Spain. But as I walk around one mountainside, the forest looks pretty clean. Helping to keep it that way is a logger named Oscar Hernández. The gray-bearded lumberjack emerges from the woods on his tractor, dragging behind him 10 enormous, felled and stripped pines. Climbing down to chat, Hernández tells me he's been at this his whole life, like his dad, he says, and his granddad 100 years ago. My grandfather used oxen, he says, to drag his draw of pines down the mountain. The draw, or allotment of trees here, predates his grandfather by several generations. It was established by royal decree beginning in the 13th century, the aim to get people to move back closer to abandoned forests. In exchange for resettling them, families were allowed to exploit trees and other forest materials for personal profit. In my grandfather's day, each family had rights to, say, 5 or 10 trees, says Hernández. The landowners would mark all the trees that needed felling with numbers, he says. Then families would pick the numbers randomly. After that, it was up to each family to go out and fell their allotment to sell them. 5 or 10 trees might not sound like a lot of wood, but these are towering Scotch pines reaching to 100 feet or more. They're used in construction and for furniture, and they were traditionally worth a lot of money. So the draw of pines creates a classic win-win, says local forestry engineer Pedro Medrano. The forest is taken care of, and the people too.
Entonces, a partir de ahí, se genera una economía en torno a la corta, al derramado, al arrastre y al aserrado de esos árboles.
It generates an entire economy around felling, trimming, transporting, and milling these trees, he says. Small cooperatives sprung up, along with specialized guilds. There were those who focused solely on collecting the cut branches for fuel. The draw of pines gained some fame this summer as fires raged through forests nearby, but not here. Newspapers held up the draw as a model for fire prevention. And that actually rankles Medrano, who runs the Soria Forestry Association, representing forest owners.
Y hoy seguimos, tenemos una vacuna.
When you read in the local press that the draw of pines is a vaccine, he says, or some sort of superhero shield against big fires, that's just plain false. It was true, says Medrano, but the way things have been going in recent decades, he says, the draw is in danger of becoming irrelevant for several reasons. First, he says, the draw was designed for a pre-industrial agrarian world.
Esa sociedad que efectivamente podemos decir que fue el óptimo.
The society back then was optimal, he says, but today, not everyone works and lives in the forest. Today, in the 36 small towns that abut the forest, you've got barbers and bar owners, car mechanics and IT specialists, people with no time to cut trees. So huge swaths of the forest are becoming overgrown. That creates a fire hazard. The logger Oscar Hernández agrees. He says he's the only one of his 5 brothers who still works in the woods. And all of the young people have left, he says. They're not interested in this life of toil. My own son, who's 18, doesn't want to do this. He's in college, studying IT. I don't want him to follow in my footsteps either, he says. As a landowner, Hernández gets money via the draw of pines, but each year it's less, adding another disincentive to forestry work. One reason for the dwindling draw, the price of wood has not kept up with the cost of labor over the last few decades. So extracting the lumber costs more, and it fetches less at market. Today, a lot of people limit their forestry work to collecting a few fallen branches for firewood. Mario Sori is in his yard in the town of Covaleda, cutting up what he's collected. He says the forest used to be an attractive source of income. My dad used to earn the same from the trees he got via the draw of pines as what he'd make working an entire year in a factory, he says. Sounds like pretty decent money. Hardly surprising, then, that some years back, the draw caught the attention of Spain's tax authorities. Earnings from the draw now get dinged at the local, regional, and federal levels. One of the only few viable forestry businesses left around here, Sori says, is the sawmill down the road. I pop over to meet owner Carlos Jimeno. Business is good, he tells me, but that's because there are no competitors left. Covaleda's several other mills have all closed up shop. The towns around here are in decline, he says, shaking his head. The population here has dropped from 2,500 to 1,000, and I can't find anyone to work. I just hired a newly arrived immigrant from Mali, he says, because there's no one else. To keep people from moving away, says Pedro Madrano, the local forestry sector needs reforms and new incentives.
Simplificación de trámites, que haya un subsidio para las épocas de paro.
We need to simplify all the paperwork, he says, and to subsidize the forestry work. When you see the number of forest maintenance companies drop from 15 to 2, he says, you're seeing the social and economic fabric of the forest disappear. Two crews to cover all those thousands of acres. No wonder the forest floor is growing thick with brush and brambles, says forestry worker Ismael Ayuso. He's up on the same mountain as logger Hernandez. Ayuso has a small business collecting scrap wood for pellets. So much brush is accumulating, it's hard to walk around up there, he says, pausing in his truck to talk. This place, he says, is becoming a powder keg, just like the forest that did burn this summer in nearby provinces. Ayuso, Hernandez, and a third logger, Javier Antolin, say that the draw of pines is worth reinvigorating because work like theirs does help reduce the severity of fires. It's just not enough. If something isn't done, says Antolin, the fate of the Urbión will be left to luck. Earlier this summer, he recounts, while working in the forest, I saw a guy walking along just flick his cigarette butt into the brush. I said, "Do you realize what you're doing?" "Oh, sorry, the guy says. Just one thoughtless gesture, Antolin says, stands between centuries of sustainable stewardship of this forest and devastating flames. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Soria, Spain.
Coming up, female athletes competing in the international spotlight will soon be required to take a genetic test to determine their biological sex. This issue has been a thing for a lot longer than you might realize. That story is just ahead.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The World Athletics Championships kicks off tomorrow in Tokyo. That is track and field here in these parts. There's a new test that female athletes will have to take before being able to participate, a controversial genetic test that's aimed at determining their biological sex. The new policy was enacted by World Athletics, the global governing body for track and field, as the world's Bianca Hillier reports.
At a press conference earlier this year, World Athletics President Sebastian Coe said over 70 groups were consulted on the policy, including national federations, athletes, and coaches.
And overwhelmingly, the view has come back that this is absolutely the way to go. We will doggedly protect the female category, and we'll do whatever is necessary to do it.
Protecting the female category has become one of the most discussed topics in elite sport. In part, supporters say they want to protect fairness and integrity in the women's category, which they see as under threat from athletes with unfair biological advantages. That often refers to transgender athletes or those with differences of sexual development. But critics point out that biological advantages are common in sports.
All sport is built on biological variation. Height, lung capacity, fast twitch muscle fibers, VO2 max, limb length.
Katrina Karkazis is a cultural anthropologist and bioethicist who specializes in sex and gender studies. She says while some biological advantages are celebrated, like the wingspan on Michael Phelps or Yao Ming's height, others, like hormone levels, are strictly governed.
So there's no clear boundary about what counts as unfair advantage. What would be permissible or impermissible. And so this, I think, exposes how subjective and political these kinds of regulations are.
Poyoshni Mitra agrees that these new tests are part of a political game. She's been advocating for athletes impacted by sex testing for nearly two decades.
This is a very problematic set of regulations that they have brought in.
Instead of protecting athletes, she says the new tests open them up for public scrutiny. If World Athletics President Sebastian Coe really wants to protect women in sports, Mitra suggests tackling more pressing issues.
Like equal pay, you know, ensuring that there is no sexual abuse or harassment in sport.
The tests that are now mandatory for athletes in the female category are looking for something called the SRY gene. If a woman has the gene, she'll be disqualified. World Athletics says it's a reliable proxy for determining biological sex. Dr. Eric Villain is a geneticist who specializes in sexual development. He says the SRY gene is on the Y chromosome, so
when this gene is present, most of the time, the individual will become male.
Most of the time, but not always. Dr. Villain says the new World Athletics test ignores the exceptions.
There are a small number of cases in which the SRY gene will carry a mutation and, in fact, will be born female.
So a woman could have the gene and be disqualified. Aside from what does or does not define sex, Dr. Villain has additional issues with the new regulations. He says genetic testing should be voluntary, but in this case,
the athletes don't have a real choice of saying yes or no to this test, because if they say no, the immediate consequence is they cannot compete.
Critics have also raised privacy concerns over how data will be handled. World Athletics did not reply to repeated interview requests for this story. But at a press conference this week, the organization's president, Sebastian Coe, said no athletes have come forward with privacy concerns.
Our medical delegate is the only one that will see the test. If there is anything to be followed up on, they will follow it up directly with the athlete. And as and when the information that we glean is deemed useful and absorbed, it is then destroyed.
He's also made the point that all this test takes is a cheek swab or blood test. The controversy may feel particular to this moment, but the tests and the controversy surrounding them go back a long time. It's really just the latest in a long history of sex testing in elite women's sport. The concept first showed up in the 1930s. At the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, an 18-year-old U.S. runner named Helen Stevens stunned everyone with her speed on the track.
Der Weg ist frei für Amerika. Helen Stevens stürmt als erste durchs Ziel.
She won the 4x100-meter relay and the 100-meter dash. That was a big surprise. A Polish runner named Stella Walsh was largely expected to grab gold. So when Walsh got second, Polish media was furious and accused first-place Stevens of being a man, says David Walachinski, an Olympic historian.
And so they demanded that the organizing committee examine Helen Stevens. So they gave her a visual exam. She was a woman. And that was the end of that.
Visual exams for any athlete suspected to not be a woman became common policy. Then in the 1960s, the policy expanded to all women. Mandatory visual inspections were known as nude parades. Athletes at the time called them peek and poke tests. The practice was widely criticized and abolished after a couple of years. So sports governing bodies moved on to other testing methods that they thought would be less invasive. First, chromosome tests. And women had to carry around little cards verifying they were women. Then the SRY gene was discovered in 1990. Yes, it's the same one tested for in today's regulations. Geneticist Dr. Eric Villain again.
SRY testing has been used before from 1992 all the way to 1999 when it was discontinued by the International Olympic Committee.
He says it was discontinued then because there wasn't evidence that people with the gene had an athletic advantage.
It was recognized by many genetics experts that SRY by itself was not enough of a good marker for athletic abilities.
Olympic officials agreed to suspend sex testing for the 2000 Games in Sydney. The next marker widely used in elite sport was testosterone levels. To Katrina Karkazis, all of these changes prove a point.
There's no single biological marker that can capture the complexity of sex. It's one of the reasons why sports governing bodies over time have cycled through these various markers, because they've always had to confront the limitations with any one specific marker that they've chosen.
Karkazis says she doesn't blame athletes who wonder if biological markers like chromosomes, hormones, or genitalia do provide an unfair advantage in sports, because she says that's a really potent discourse in society, and most schools simply don't teach about the complexity of sex. Karkazis admits that education alone may not solve the problem.
But not to have done it at all, I think, has really allowed a lot of misconceptions to continue and to sort of be the core of these debates.
Coaches and athletes have been pretty quiet in the wake of the test announcement, at least publicly. I reached out to more than a dozen women who are competing at this month's World Championships to hear what they think about the tests. Nobody granted an interview. At a press conference this week, World Athletics President Sebastian Coe said over 95% of women have completed the test.
With the remainder of tests, the French team, the Norwegian team, and some athletes based in France being done here in Tokyo ahead of competition.
The reason those athletes didn't take the test back home? They're illegal under national bioethics laws. Here's how Coe responded when asked about that this week.
Yeah, some nations will have national laws in place, but actually on this occasion where they have, we've actually managed to work our way around those in a sensible and a constructive way.
For supporters, that workaround is proof the policy can be implemented worldwide. For critics, it's more evidence that the tests are illegitimate. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
If you put together a greatest hits album from the natural world, you would need to include this. Underwater recordings captured the complexity and beauty of humpback whale songs more than 50 years ago. But the mechanism by which these creatures vocalize is only just being figured out. Magnus Wahlberg is part of the team that's done research on this. He's an associate professor at the University of Southern Denmark. Magnus, what was known up until this new research about how they made these songs?
So it's a very difficult topic to study, right? If you want to know how humans make sounds, you would probably put a camera into your throat and you would measure with some pressure sensors what's going on. And we can obviously not do that with these very big animals.
Another baleen whale is the minke whale. Let's listen to the recording of that whale made in the wild. This sounds so different from that humpback whale. Is it the same kind of vocal apparatus?
So that's a big surprise that even though all these baleen whales make rather low-pitched sounds, there's big diversity. So this is a minke whale call, and it's made with the same kind of sound apparatus. You also have the blue whale, the fin whale. They also make these kind of very low frequency calls, and presumably then with exactly the same mechanisms.
And so you and your collaborators studied the voice boxes that were removed from the carcasses of three baleen whales. Those are those whales that filter feed instead of having teeth. What did you discover?
These are the really big, the biggest mammals ever living on the planet. And they are obviously very difficult to get hold of, but we had the opportunity then to get hold of three stranded specimens that were still in a very good condition. The problem is also once they strand and die, they decompose very rapidly. So you have to get hold of this tissue very rapidly. And we had some good networks with people to help us. And then we brought the larynx from these animals, so the voice box, to the lab, and we could then attach them to our measurement equipment and blow sounds through them. And we could actually detect and document how sounds were actually coming out from the how the mechanics were of these voice boxes.
Can you describe how you tested the whale voice boxes that you were working with?
So we got the voice boxes from stranded individuals and we brought them to the lab, and then we hanged them up in an experimental device that we had constructed where we could pump in air through the voice box and then record sounds and use videos. And we also had accelerometers or motion sensors to understand how vibrations were created, and that led to this sound production.
And you had a balloon full of air, basically, that you pushed through these voice boxes.
Yeah, so one of the challenges was to create airflow that was enough. And the way we did that was to have a huge air balloon that we could squeeze and in that way create a steady airflow that was massive enough to make the larynx sing.
So let's hear one of those tests now. So what are we hearing there?
It takes some experience to decipher what's going on here, but it's actually the sound made by this larynx when you blow air through it. And of course, it doesn't sound like a perfect minke whale, but if you analyze this in detail, you can actually understand the function of sound production, and the sound has the features and components needed for actual sound production. But actual sound production in a live animal involves not only your vocal folds and blowing air through them, it also involves a lot of different muscles. It's a very fine mechanism where that steers the tension of the voice box and so on, and so to generate different types of sounds. So it's very difficult to reproduce the actual sounds made by a live animal by doing these kind of experiments. But we can at least confirm that we have all the components needed for a minke whale to make its sounds.
So can you describe what these voice boxes look like and how they work?
Yeah, so the first impression when you dissect one out is how big they are, right? So these animals, we're talking about up to 50 feet animals in length. So the voice box in these animals, they weigh several tens of metric tons, the whole animal. And the voice box itself, you know, it's big as a medium-sized dog. It's a big lump of tissue.
Big as a medium-sized dog, you said?
Yeah, I think it was something like, you know, 20, 30 pounds or something like that.
When you were working with these real whale voice boxes and running air through them to create sound, were you surprised by how they worked or what it sounded like?
Well, I was quite surprised. So my expertise is mainly on I'm mainly doing field recordings of whales. So I'm often out and recording them and trying to understand what they say to each other. So my real expertise is not in these sound production organs. But my part of this study was really to help the main author, Professor Elements, to get hold of the tissues and to set up the experiments and so on. So this was actually one of the first times when I was experiencing these kind of experiments live. And I must say I was quite surprised because it was quite a big setup that that Elements had to make this happen. And in the middle of this huge setup, you had this big larynx that we hooked up with all the measurement devices, film cameras and so on. And when he started to blow air through it and started to manipulate this this big chunk of tissue, it started to sound like a whale. So that was pretty, it was a pretty amazing experience, actually.
So what conclusions was your team able to draw from this research?
So, I mean, a major conclusion is that, I mean, the only way we have been able to understand how baleen whales make sounds is from anatomical investigation. So this is the first time when we can actually present how these tissues function. One of the things with whales is that they have lungs, they are mammals, so they have to come out to the surface and breathe, and then they collect air, and that's the air they have to make sounds. And the deeper they dive, the smaller this air volume will be because it will be compressed. So at a certain depth, there will simply not be air enough to drive the vocal organ. And we could actually make some modeling and some predictions at which depth this system will stop functioning. And the surprising, and that was a major surprise for me who work with the behavior of these animals, to see that we could actually predict that at a couple of hundred meters, or you know, maybe 400 or 500 feet or so, they would not be able to produce sounds anymore.
Well, vocalizations are important to their survival. They're used for what? Echolocation, communication, mating. What more does this research tell us about their ability to survive in our modern oceans with lots of noise pollution?
Yes, I think it gives some extra information to this whole debate about noise pollution, because one issue with a lot of the noise we generate in the waters nowadays comes from ships and other activities rather close to the surface. So you could say that if the whales are constrained to make sounds in the upper layers of the oceans, this will be also the most noisy part of the ocean. And there is a great overlap between the frequencies produced by boats and shipping and the sound that whales are making. And whales are making sounds very much like birds do. They do it both to communicate between one another, but a very important function with these sounds is to simply sing and display and to find a mate and so on and so forth. And if they are then masked by shipping noise, that could generate some problems for them.
Magnus Valberg is an associate professor at the University of Southern Denmark. I spoke with him last year about his research into the voice box of baleen whales, including the humpback whale. Tensions across NATO's eastern flank were already running high, and then Russian drones flew into Poland this week. And that is just making things worse. We will have the latest from the Baltic states. You are listening to The World. NATO says it will step up its air defenses in Eastern Europe. This follows an incident on Wednesday when Russian drones crossed into Polish airspace. Meanwhile, Russia and Belarus are starting joint military exercises. They're called Zapad or West. The last time they were held in 2022, Russia sent troops into Ukraine just days later. Poland, Latvia, and Lithuania share borders with Belarus, and tensions are running high in all three countries. DW's Lisa Louie sent us this report from the Lithuanian border.
From where I'm standing in Lithuania, Belarus is just 15 meters away. But I can't just walk across this 600-kilometer-long border. It's equipped with a double fence with barbed wire and surveillance cameras. The Lithuanians want to make sure that no one crosses this line undetected, as the country knows what a Russian invasion would mean. Until 1991, Lithuania was part of the Soviet Union. On this sunny Wednesday afternoon, I'm accompanying two soldiers on a patrol along the stretch of land. They've been receiving extra training over the past few weeks to prepare for potential border transgressions, as Lithuanian authorities are wary.
Reinforcement of border surveillance at the border.
Here's General Rustamas Liubajevas from the Lithuanian Border Control.
Now Russia is much more seriously taken as a possible aggressor. Well, we're preparing for a very broad range of provocations. Those might be use of migrants, aggressive actions at the border against border guards by migrants, when the migrants are being instructed by Belarusian to be very aggressive, to use different tools to attack border guards. Those might be also use of drones.
As has happened during previous drills in the past, thousands of soldiers will test military equipment like tanks, drones and machine guns. But this time, they'll also be trained in the use of Russia's new intermediate-range nuclear-capable ballistic missile Oreshnik. Lithuania, though, is adamant it won't blink first. Vilnius has been increasing its annual defence spending from under 2% of GDP in 2021 to over 5% next year. The country is also organising its own military drills these days, jointly with Estonia, Latvia and Poland. Up to 40,000 soldiers are to take part.
Hello.
Hello. Hi. This is Louis.
Nice to meet you.
Deutsche. Nice to meet you.
And yet, there's concern the Russian-Belarusian military exercises could increase the threat level in the long run, says Linas Kujala, head of Vilnius-based think tank Geopolitics and Security Center.
Russia perceives us as countries, more as territories that should be under Kremlin's direct or indirect control. What we are going to be looking for is certainly whether those troops that are going to be in Belarus or around Belarus are going to be staying there after the exercise, whether Russia is really increasing its presence on the Belarusian soil, including the infrastructure, and possibly preparing for some scenarios in 2, 5, 7, or 10 years.
The fear of an attack has been scaring many here, especially since the start of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, says Margarita Seselgita, the director of the Institute of International Relations and Political Science at Vilnius University.
So it comes with the information, cyber attacks.
According to a 2024 poll, 70% of Lithuanians perceive Russia as a threat.
During the first weeks of Russian war against Ukraine, there were a lot of people who were considering leaving the country. I also heard a number of people thinking that they should take their families out of Lithuania during the actual Zapad exercises, because there was this feeling that, you know, something might happen.
Seselgita adds that people just can't help drawing a direct comparison with Russian military build-up on the Ukrainian border in late 2021.
Initially, those troops were moved to the border for the exercise, and then they've been reinforced, and that was the start of the war. So, you know, having in mind these historical examples, sometimes you can jump to conclusions.
Experts think an attack on one of the Baltic states is unlikely with the Ukraine war still ongoing. Russia won't have the resources for two fronts, they say. But the inhabitants of the small Lithuanian village of Gulbina, just a few kilometers away from the border with Belarus, are still on edge. Aida Taraskevich and her husband Meshislav have lived in one of the village's seven houses for almost two decades. They describe an atmosphere of fear ahead of the drills. Most residents here are against the drills, Meshislav told me. It's really frightening, he added, especially as it's just around the corner. We all fear that this war will soon come to us, his wife Aida agreed. We are afraid, really afraid. With Russia clearly showing an expansionist agenda, these fears are unlikely to dissipate anytime soon. At some point in the future, the Lithuanian border could become the country's first line of defense.
That's DW's Lisa Louie reporting from the Lithuania-Belarus border. To close out today's show, we're going to reintroduce you to Michael Kiwanuka. We've been keeping an eye on the British singer-songwriter for more than a decade. Kiwanuka Iwanuka put out his first album called Home Again in 2012. His fourth record, Small Changes, dropped late last year. Iwanuka grew up in London. His parents were exiles from Uganda who left in the 1970s during the reign of dictator Idi Amin. Iwanuka has spoken about his angst when he was a kid, not seeing other black teenagers in any of the rock music videos he liked on MTV. His latest album has tracks that seem to echo his own path as a musician. The title track on Small Changes alludes to staying true to a sound he introduced us to at the start of his career. But with production help from Danger Mouse, formerly half of Gnarls Barkley, not to mention many other credits, Kiwanuka's style stretches out, like with this dark love song called Live for Your Love. And that will do it for us this Friday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. We are online at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great weekend, and we will see you back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust, Cindy Ingalls, Dodie and Billy Crockett, and Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.